Okay, so today's edition of the Your Law Firm Success podcast was with Pete Jackson, the soon-to-be retiring CEO of Hill Dickinson. Hill Dickinson is a mid-market law firm turning over around about 140 million. During Pete's time, he's been there from going from roughly about 50 members of staff to 1,000. So he's been through it all, from small to large firm. One of the subjects that we cover in some detail, which I think is really, really interesting, is around the impact of the billable hour and its impact, or perhaps conflict. No, in fact, we didn't find it to be a conflict. Its impact on the client-solicitor relationship, and also on the extent to which a solicitor can find purpose within their job. I hope you enjoy it, and thank you for listening. Peter, thank you very much. Thank you very much for your time. You have been the CEO of Hill Dickinson for some time now and are due to retire. I was wondering if we could start off with a bit of background on you. I know you started off from a recent article as a glass collector, but you've obviously moved on from there.
Yeah, I think I've gone down in the world, but we're coping with it. We're coping with it. Yeah, so my first interest in the law really came by chance, because I did what we used to call arts A-levels at school. English and history was what I really enjoyed. I turned up at French lessons, and I think I got a pass in it, but it was only just. But I really had no idea how I would use that education, save that I knew somewhat instinctively then that I didn't want necessarily to be a teacher. That wasn't where I envisaged going. And it was a very close pal of mine, a family friend, who had done a similar route to the same school but a few years before me, and had gone off to university to study law. That sort of gave me the idea, because as he described the study, the sort of things that he did, that piqued my interest. In a number of ways, I mean, I found it interesting as a subject in principle. I was a bit of a swot, if the truth be known. I didn't mind studying and working hard, and it sounded like a subject that was part practical but very academic as well, and for some rather sad reason that appealed to me. So I applied to do law, was fortunate to get in, and did it. I still then, for a couple of years, had no idea where it was leading me in terms of a meaningful and gainful employment at the end of the day. Second year of uni, my tutor made it clear that not having an idea where I might be going with this wasn't really the best thing I could do. And at that point, really, it was a choice between going to the bar to become a barrister or into private practice to become a solicitor, or at least it was for me anyway. I didn't think then that I was going to be quick enough on my feet to be a barrister. And engage in wise debate with learned members of the bar, judges. So I took what I thought was the easy route and applied to go to College of Law to become a solicitor. And also then had to apply for what we then called Articles of Clerkship to train to be a solicitor. And through a rather windy route, I ended up at Hill Dickinson. I did an internship for a couple of years here, then in the early 80s, and then started on the 1st September 1983 as an article clerk. Was paid a princely sum of £3,500 per annum for the privilege of learning at the feet of the masters. And to be honest, it wasn't long after the payment regime was the other way around, that if you wanted articles, you had to cough up for them. Thankfully, really? That had changed by my day. Yeah, it had changed by my day, but that was the older idea. So, yeah, 1st September 1983.
Okay, so that's, and I was not that good at maths at school, but that's 40 years
Locked
ago this
that,
September.
That'll do, yeah.
Tell me about Hill Dickinson at that point.
Yeah, Hildingson at that point was an entirely different business to that which it is today. It had offices in Liverpool and London that weren't in any way really coordinated. They were just two businesses with an element of goodwill that operated separately. I think we're about 10 partners in Liverpool. There weren't many qualified lawyers below the rank of partner. It was very top-heavy. Partners were workers. You know, the idea of business development in any scientific or structured way wasn't really on the agenda. There was no transparency about how the firm was doing financially, so far as I was concerned, as an article clerk. And in fact, quite frankly, for some years afterwards, it was a very different culture. I do remember going out with my principal to the slaughterhouse in Liverpool city centre for a good night out, the night that the Liverpool office billed £1 million per annum for the first time ever.
So can you tell me about Hill Dickinson today, then, by means of contrast?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, by terms of contrast. Well, I mean, this year we will turn over around about £140 million sterling. We've got 1,000 people, 155 of them are partners of one form, shape or another. We're in Liverpool, London, Leeds, Manchester, Birmingham. I'm sure I've forgotten something there, Newcastle, in the UK. And we have overseas offices in Monaco, Hong Kong, Singapore and Athens, Piraeus. With associated offices in Cyprus and in Geneva. So it's a very, when I say it was a totally different animal, I mean, it's unrecognisable to what it is today.
And so can you remember how many staff were in it when you started in 1983?
Oh, I'm trying to think. If it was 50, including the partners in Liverpool at the time, I might be exaggerating, to be honest. Okay. It was a relatively small operation, yeah.
So this is quite interesting, I think, because this, you know, the Your Law Firm Success podcast is focused primarily on the sort of majority of the legal market in the UK, which, you know, small to medium-sized practices. And you obviously started when Hill Dickinson would be regarded now as being a small firm.
Oh, very now, much so. Yeah.
Now it's a large firm. And you've been there throughout. And I think, I imagine that many people couldn't see themselves going from being a 50-person firm to a 1,000-partner firm, but you've been on that journey. Well, can you tell me a bit, please, about your involvement in that and your movement from obviously being, we talked about you being an article clerk, you know, a trainee, moving into being qualified and then moving into management?
Yeah, sure. My involvement in the growth really came in the second phase of my career, as I put it, as a leader, as a manager. Although there were elements of growth in the early part, so I qualified in 1985 and became a marine lawyer, shipping lawyer, practicing in Liverpool for a good few years. My client base was really marine insurers, so some of the old names of UK insurance, Royal Insurance before it became RSA, Sun Alliance that joined with it, Royal Commercial Union, good old names, Norwich Union, and that was my client base, because they would insure cargoes, they would insure pleasure crafts, they would insure marine assets, and when things went wrong we would be brought in to advise them. That was very much the nature of what I did. Many of my insurer clients, or our insurer clients, moved from Liverpool to Manchester during the course of the 90s. And there was a shift in the insurance power base in the Northwest. And the broking houses, of course, that generate business for insurers, were becoming to be really focused in Manchester. So we opened an office in Manchester in 1997, and I moved over to head that office for 8 years. Continued practicing in the same way, but also became gradually over that period not disillusioned with practicing law, as myself. Not disillusioned is the wrong word, but I was beginning to see that if that was all it was, then I'm not sure it was for the rest of my life. And as I say, that wasn't a sense of disillusionment. It was just a sense of I've probably gone as far as I can go as a practicing lawyer without making some dramatic changes and moving into new disciplines or whatever, which is very difficult to do. I became deputy managing partner first, which was no promise of the big seat, but it was we needed a deputy to help David out. David Waring was this man. And ultimately was elected by the partners to be his successor in 2005, managing partner. And at that point, I stopped practicing because we were then at a size that the partners felt, and I agreed with them, that trying to manage the business and manage a caseload of reinsurance work and clients was going to end in disaster somewhere, potentially. Mm-hmm. So I had to focus on one or the other, and I was comfortable with that. And in the sort of 12 months leading up to it, we'd gradually introduced others to my client base, and I had a successor in the team anyway, who was clearly going to do a better job than I did, quite frankly, and that's the way it should be, isn't it? To be honest, and he has done, by the way, still doing so. But no, he's doing a great job. But we started the handover, the transition, if you like, of the fee earning, the client work, to Adrian and the team. We didn't lose a client on the back of it. Not quite sure what that says about my prowess as a lawyer, but never mind, eh? But he did a great job in keeping it, and that freed me up to go into management. With a clear slate, so to speak. Just to finish on one final point, the size of the business when that happened was about 35 million turnover. So we'd grown substantially over the years leading up to that. Mm-hmm. And we were then still only in Liverpool, Manchester and London. We'd gone back into London a couple of years. Well, we'd gone back into London during the 90s.
So this was in the early 2000s, this change happened?
2005. 1st of November 2005, I took over as managing partner. Yep.
And what was it about management that appealed to you? And what do you think are the most important elements of behaviour that you had to change as a result of transitioning from being a fee earner, a technician, to becoming a manager?
Yeah. What attracted me, I think, was... It was the leadership role. It was a job spec, if you want to put it that way, that I thought I would find really interesting and satisfying. And I could... I had a little bit of a vision about where we might do things better and take things on. And that sort of led me to put my hat in the ring and ultimately get it.
The second part of that was, what skills behaviors. Do you think?
I mean, one thing I would say, and I'm sure you've heard this from other law firm managing partners who are my generation, we didn't have a clue what we were doing, truth be known, in the sense that there was, certainly for firms of our ilk at the time, there was really very little by way of consultancy, management development skills, set training courses or stuff like that. I'm sure they were there because it is only 20 years ago, for heaven's sake. But in terms of where we were in the market, there was no suggestion that I'd go off before I took over and do courses here and courses there. I chose to do something like that immediately afterwards because I realised there was a gap in skill set. And I did the Harvard course a couple of years after I started. But I had no training going in. So it was inevitably in the early stage, it was self-taught and gut feel. What a number of things I thought really had to change. I think with any lawyer who does defence work, there's an element of reactivity in how you behave. Because, you try to defend your client's interests. If no one's protecting them or their protection is not being challenged at a particular moment, then why make matters worse? You know, you can leave things alone. You can't do that when you're leading. You've got to be on the ball and drive things forward all the time. And that's fine. I recognised that pretty early on. I also recognised, because I was a litigator, and, you know, the first reaction in any litigator is to fight, and we'll settle it down the line, you know, once we've established our position. Well, you can't run a business as a litigator if that's your mindset. Because it just won't work. Particularly in a partnership where you've got multiple stakeholders and you have to take them with you on any serious decisions. And that was a bit of a wake-up call for me as well, that the idea of autocracy wasn't going to happen. And, you know, for good or bad, there was a level of democracy you had to have. And that required skills of persuasion slightly different to those you might have as a litigator, much more conciliatory, much more that of bringing people with you rather than fighting against people to get your own way or your client's way. So that had to change pretty quickly. And I realised that very early on. Probably made a few mistakes in the early months by being perhaps a bit too aggressive and dictatorial. But I did realise that had to change early, and I was able to get my head around that and accommodate it. What I didn't realise early on enough, I think, was just how much of a role model you are as the leader, inevitably, and whatever the size of your business and whatever the size of those who follow you, you know, whether it's me at the time with whatever it was, 40 partners, or a team leader as a partner with, you know, an article clerk, a secretary, and an assistant, how you behave matters. How you behave will be replicated by them or seriously disliked by them, in which case they won't be there for long. And I'm not sure that really hit me as quickly as it should have done. I get it now, and I've had it for many, many years, but in the early stages, probably underestimated the quite the authority you've got in that sense of being a role model for others, which did take a bit of time to get my head around.
I think that's... it's something I've been very aware of, and I think you can be aware of that in almost every single circumstance where you go into a business, however you experience it, whether it's the local gym or the local shop or wherever it might be, you know, where there's a number of people working and the leader behaves in a particular way, and as a result, all the rest of the staff follow that. And if that leader is setting a very strong example of the culture or the way that in which they wish to interact with people that's positive, the others follow. And it's the same in a negative sense. And I'm wondering, just, you know, briefly, if you've got any particular sources of inspiration for your leadership style that you've taken or observed or watched over the past, that you've thought they're doing that absolutely brilliantly. You know, obviously it might not be somebody you've worked with. It might be, you know, we before we went on the call, we were chatting about Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I'd love to say I had worked with Jurgen Klopp, wouldn't we all? But but I think actually, all joking aside, Jurgen Klopp's a very, very good example. And as you know, I'm a Liverpool fan, have been man and boy for 50 years going to Anfield. I was acutely aware of the culture at the club amongst the stakeholders, the fans, whatever, before Jurgen Klopp took over. He, as the leader, did. Doesn't matter which club he's in, does it? He, as a leader, came in and basically took hold of the club in the operational sense, not the financial sense, that was dealt with by others, but the operational sense of how his people, his team, his players behaved, how they bonded as a unit, how they would operate, you know, how they would play on the field. And that had been totally, perceptibly, totally missing for some time. And if you read now, because they're starting to come out, because we're into phase two of his, you know, leadership period, aren't we? And so those who were there in phase one are starting to speak on podcasts and write books and give a bit of an insight to what he did. He put people first. And it wasn't just about the senior partners, the stars, the goal scorers, or whatever, however you want to define them. It was about the staff in the canteen. You know, it was about the receptionists at the training ground. It was about the caretaker. They were all part of the business. They all had a role to play. It's the old story about, you know, Kennedy asking the sweeper at Cape Canaveral what he does, or Cape Kennedy what he does. Well, you know, I said men to the moon. That was the ethos that he brought into the club at that point. And he also won over the stakeholders. And I do have to be a bit technical on football again, but I think it tells the story, because what Klopp realised was he needed his customers on his side, that he had to recreate that bond between the operational team, the players, and the customers. What is the difference between that elite sporting environment and a mid-market law firm like your Dickinson? Any professional service firm. It's all about people. It's all about the skill sets of the people. It's all about the people working as one unit and not as silos. It's all very well having Mo Salah play, but if no one gives him the ball because he's a greedy so-and-so, they ain't going to score any goals.
Mm.
Got to behave as a collective. And that was what Klopp was trying to achieve. So very inspirational.
To go into that a bit more, which I think is quite interesting, is one of the things that we've been discussing recently on the podcast is the billable hour. And the impact of the billable hour on purpose, and also on the relationship that one can have with one's clients. Because coming at it from one point of view would say, well, actually they're in conflict, because one party wishes the matter to be concluded quickly and the other one has got fee targets to meet and has perhaps a motivation to keep that running. And you talked about the relationship between the club and its customers, which are its fans, whereas it's different, you know, for law firms because of that dynamic. What are your thoughts around that whole side of things? Because that's been it's been something that's been raised a number of times.
Yeah, I think if the reality is that you have that conflict dynamic, the relationship with the client is all wrong. That idea that the law firm should have a desire to run the case, the deal, the matter, whatever it is, for all it's worth, whatever the client's best interests are, if that is the real view of the law firm, then that wouldn't be, if I were a client, entirely acceptable. In fact, it'd be totally unacceptable. And it would also, I think, go totally against the idea I believe in, that the best relationship between a client and his law firm, her law firm, is when the law firm is seen as a trusted advisor. They happen to be a lawyer, and the legalities may be what they are technically most proficient in, but the best relationships are those where the partner, the lawyer, whoever it may be, is consulted on anything that might be important to the business client, regardless of whether it's got legal implications or not, because the way of thinking, the trust and respect that exists between the client and the law firm is such that the client would just thinks he would benefit from having a view. Might not follow it, might decide that actually no, I want to do something else. But the relationship is such that he wants to know what his lawyer thinks. Anything that is predicated on, well, I'm working for this client, so I must get as many billable hours under my belt as possible to upgrade the fee, is totally eroding that trust and respect. And the reality in any commercial situation with a client is that the client's only going to do one job on that basis, because as soon as he realises that his interests do not coincide with his own advisors, then that's the end of the relationship. You have to put your client's best interests first to your own detriment. You have to be, I think, totally transparent about that. And that's how you win trust and respect. And that's how you win work. It's a long game. You know, being cynical and commercial at the end of that nice little philosophical monologue, the best way commercially is to have a client for the long time and a short-term approach of massively milking the billable hour doesn't achieve that objective. in my view, and isn't in the client's best interest. So I don't think there should be a conflict between the billable hour and the client relationship. If there is, you've got a bad relationship and it ain't going to last, quite frankly. You've got to have that sink.
So I was going to ask, do you think if there is a conflict in that way, then there's also an issue with the way in which the fee earner is being targeted and managed around the way in which they deal, bill and work with their client base?
If there is that relationship, then yes, there is. And whether it's driven by poor management on the part of the law firm or poor communication between the management of the law firm and its players, its lawyers, I don't know, it may be either, may it not, but a sophisticated, mature management team would realise that they're actually just asking its staff to milk billable hours is not in the business's best interests, because it will create a number of short-term client relationships. And that's not how you grow your business. That's not how you provide best service. It's not how you satisfy your clients' interests to the best endeavour. It's not. So, if that exists, it's not a happy situation.
I think it's something that's come up as being a sort of assumption, and maybe it's an assumption of mine sometimes because of the existence of the billable hour. And I'm wondering how you know, what your approach to that is with your fee earners in terms of training, management, growth, moving into partnership, because obviously there are financial targets to be met.
Yes, there are. And I don't think there is anything mutually exclusive about the sort of ethos I've spoken about of, you know, partnership attitude towards the client relationship, trusted advisor type. And me as a leader, me as the head of a management team, insisting that our lawyers do 1,500 chargeable hours per year. We have our own commercial objectives, and we have to have our players deliver in accordance with those objectives. But that's not to say that we expect them, want them, or would allow them to do that at all cost. We measure everything these days, and we have a pretty good idea for the value of a job. And that's the real, I think that's the real raison d'etre these days for the existence of the billable hour. It's how we assess value. Because certainly in the commercial world, clients have got that the billable hour is not the be all and end all. And value-based pricing has to be there. Whether it is a litigation matter that is dealt with on billable hours, fine. Or whether it is how billable hours are used to assess value in terms of a fixed fee relationship or whatever it might be. Clients get that these days. But I don't think there's any mutual exclusivity there. Also, if you've got, and I think we do have, a very good quality control system in terms of listening to our clients, getting feedback from clients, reacting to how they come back to us, we'll know if fees are out of kilter and our lawyers are trying to do things they shouldn't be doing. And if we're satisfied on any client coming back to us on that basis that that's the case, we take action, we deal with it. So I don't think there is that conflict, quite frankly.
This is really interesting, because I think if you were... We obviously, in my business, we use time recording. Of course we do. And we use time recording maybe in a much smaller scale, but maybe on a similar basis, that we use the time recording as a way of then allowing us to estimate what the cost of or the price of a job will be going forward. And then thereafter, we use it as a benchmark as to whether or not we were accurate or not, or need to move the price up or need to move the price down in order to achieve the margins that we've set as being acceptable. For smaller firms and for smaller firm leaders out there, what would you say are your best lessons from that point of view in order to begin moving away from hourly-based pricing to value-based pricing or fixed pricing, and the types of reporting that is essential to enable you to assess that effectively in advance so you don't end up shooting yourself in the foot?
Yeah. I think the first thing to say, and it's the constant dilemma debate that even we have, quite frankly, is you've got to get towards the stage of as accurate time recording as you possibly can for whatever purpose. You know, and I know lawyers these days balk about it. They always have balked about it, haven't they? It's not something that the lawyer mindset takes easily. But it is essential for a variety of reasons that you know how long it is taking you to do a particular job as a starting point. I'm not saying it's the only driver of a price range, but you've got to know, you know, what time it's taking you, how much of your associate's time is actually being taken on that deal. Because you know how much you pay him and you know how much the overhead around him is. How are you going to make a profit out of him if you don't know how much time he's spending on individual tasks? So to get towards true time recording is your first starting point, I think. The second starting point is to be absolutely clear with your client the basis on which you're doing the job. And that may sound so obvious as to be, you know, not worth saying. I think it's absolutely fundamental you say it, because so many times you see that law firms don't do that. They get so excited at the outset of a new job that they throw themselves into it, and halfway through they think, oh, bugger, I haven't got an engagement letter and we never talked about costs and we didn't do that. That's silly. In this day and age, that's leaving yourself open to all sorts of criticism. You have to have, it's back to your hired gun, trusted advisor debate, isn't it? You've got to feel confident enough to be able to say to the clients on day one, the basis on which we will charge you for this piece of work is whatever it is, hourly rate, fixed fee, capped fee, whatever route you're going to go down, be absolutely clear. And if it's one of those jobs where you think, well, there's a bit of uncertainty around this, but if we get a certain result, the fee should really be X plus Y plus Z plus A, but a vanilla result to this transaction is probably X. Well, have that conversation. Because, you know, you only get X plus A plus B plus C if you do a damn good job. Mm. I don't want you to do a damn good job. This is not an acrimonious relationship, hopefully. Be transparent about it. Be absolutely clear. Reduce it to writing. The third thing I would say is monitor it. Don't get to the end of the transaction having quoted 50 grand and suddenly find you've run up 250 grand on the clock and have to go to the clients and say, actually, when I said 50, that's just, again, that's poor management, poor matter management, poor time management. Keep an eye on it. You know, there are systems now available, aren't there, IT systems that have warning bells when you hit various levels of work in progress. That's the automated way to do it, the digital way to do it. Do it manually. But however you do it, keep a track on matters as to where you're going with them. And keep a client updated. In my experience, the client that gets the atomic bill at the end of the matter is far more unhappy than the client who may pay more but gets it gradually over the course of a matter and can manage his own cash flow about how he pays his lawyers. And, of course, that's better for your own cash flow. So I would certainly have that monitoring system in place, however you do it. Personally, I would always go for interim bills as well, for the reason I just said. In my experience, clients prefer that. You know, they like to be able to cash forecast. They like to be able to manage their cash flow, particularly if it's a chunky matter. Giving them small and often would probably be better for them than big and once at the end. Reduces your leverage as well if you've done all the work and then you're bombing them with a massive bill. Don't be surprised if they come back and say, really? Because your leverage is gone. So I would certainly advocate that as well. So four steps that may sound obvious, but you've got to make sure they happen, and they don't always.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is achieving a state of commercial alignment and understanding the types of considerations that are going to be important to the client in terms of cash flow, outcome, value, but also, which is one of my favourite things, is trying to introduce aspects to the relationship that result in a win-win. So if they win, you win too. And there's an element of risk share there as well, you know, and I think that's really, and I'm conscious of time because actually and I don't think we're going to be able to. We haven't actually spoken about what we agreed to speak about.
We're completely off piece, Stephen. We keep going. We're having fun.
in advance, but it's actually, you know, I think this billable hour element and trying to, as younger people are entering the profession and purpose is increasingly important and a sense of purpose, and I imagine you find that in terms of your recruitment, that the things that are important to younger professionals entering the legal profession now are quite different to the things that were important to you. And purpose being one of them, and understanding how you can balance purpose with the billable hour. And what you're saying to me is that actually, you know, if your management is done correctly, then that's entirely possible.
I think it is. As I say, I don't think there's an exclusivity. I think there's a commercial imperative that you do it, actually. And I think it's not just a case of being transparent with the client and in partnership with the client. It is about, I think, educating your own more junior lawyers, dare I say younger lawyers, usually the case, that a law firm is a business. And it, historically, certainly when I started, I don't think, no, I can say quite clearly, I didn't think of a law firm as a business. It was somewhere I went to practice law. And, you know, I didn't know how to make money. I didn't know what would result in me losing money. We've never taught it either. It was, yep, wasn't something that junior lawyers were expected to understand. Okay, we are a large law firm, a mid-market law firm, but we now do try to educate our lawyers in a very early stage of their careers that, yes, they are, they're first and foremost the lawyer who's there to run a process with clients, to advise clients, to whatever it might be with clients, but actually you're part of a machine that is not a charity. It's a business. It's got shareholders, stakeholders, and those stakeholders have to have a return on their investment or you ain't got a job. Simple as that. Now, you know, that's the dramatic end. So let's educate how you can help here.
Yeah.
And it's not just about the billable hour as such and pricing and all that goes with that. It's about cash collection. It's about risk. You know, will you really do that job for that client on spec with no money on account? Because we all know what's going to happen. Oh, and you've also agreed you'll bill at the end. Well, isn't that clever? And all your leverage is gone. And you've got no money in the bank and you've just run up 50 grand on the clock. And you think he's going to pay it? Okay. Let's analyze that, shall we? I think there is a piece about getting your younger lawyers in the mindset that they understand it is a business. If the client wants that, the client is going to think much more of you if you show a commercial acumen about, you know, how his business is being run. I think you'll earn respect by that from clients that you want to keep. And the sooner you can get your people in that mindset, the better. And it's a gradual thing, and not all of them will take it. But those who do take it and become more senior and ultimately want to be partners, it's absolutely essential they get it for obvious reasons, because there they are, investors in a business, they're owners of a business. If by that stage in their career they don't understand how you make money, then there's a problem, you know, a serious problem. And gradually you've got to get them to that stage. And really, they should only become partners for their own good, never mind the good of the business, if they have got that mindset, can get their head round at least a minimum of how you make and can lose money and cash flow and things that go with that. And if you know all that, I think there's no issue with the billable hour. You know,
yeah, I think you're. I mean, I've made the mistake in the past of assuming that everyone would think like me in terms of understanding, well, that'll make us money and that'll lose us money. But it's not the case. No, and sometimes it has to be fairly explicit. But I think, Pierre, we haven't covered what we're going to talk about and we won't have time to do that today, but I've really enjoyed talking to you so far and I'm wondering if we could do that again in the future, cover that bit. But just before we finish this discussion today, what I normally do at the beginning is ask I guess, what their definition of law firm success, but we'll do it today at the end, if that's okay, because we've covered a number of other things in the meantime. So for you, law firm success is what?
Okay. It's an engaged workforce, an engaged group of people with the common ambition, working in a culture that the vast majority of them find acceptable and actually enables them to operate to the best of their ability. And I think the outflow of that is a profitable business. I don't think you can have the profitable business without a culture that matches that required by your people. But if you've got a business with that culture that the vast majority, you'll never please everybody, and there'll always be outliers, but just recognize that, accept it. But if the vast, vast majority of your people are in a culture that they want to be in, that they find acceptable, that meets their professional, personal characteristics, values, whatever it might be, then they are much more likely to behave at their optimum levels and want to grow and want to bring others into the business to join them and want to drive on and seek new clients and all that goes with that. And that produces a financially successful business. At the end of the day, don't think you can have one without the other.
Okay, I think that's a great definition.
Good. Well, I think we've got it at the moment. To be honest, I think our culture is there's no good or bad culture. You know, we've all got to recognise that the culture has to be what suits the people that are in it. And what I might find a bad culture, others would thrive in, and vice versa. And you know, we could both name law firms that neither of us would want to work in, but loads of people do. And they enjoy it and they get on with it. So that's fine, not a problem. But you've got to create a culture that works for your people. And I think we've got that at the moment. And we're seeing success as a result of that. Mm. And that's the way it works for us.
I think it's obviously something you're very strong on, clear on. Whether you've been clear on it as a result the whole time or as a result of experience, your hunches or your feelings about it have been proven to be correct as a result of the results that it's delivered both for you and the other partners and other stakeholders in Hill Dickinson, you know, which then as a result underpins your confidence in that and makes it more certain for you.
It does. And also, I think, I don't mind saying that it hasn't always been like this. You know, we've had periods where, like all law firms over the last 20 years, I mean, there've been, you know, ups and downs for everybody. But, as recently as 7 or 8 years ago, there was a part of our business that no longer fitted. And it's common knowledge, I'm not telling any tales out of school. And at that point in time, the culture wasn't right because we didn't have a common alignment. We had financial issues and the result of the bit that didn't fit that we're impinging on the whole of the business because we're one firm, one partnership financially. We don't separate out profit pools or anything like that. And as a consequence of that, we had the reverse. The culture had gone and we had a part that was sticking out and we had to do something about it. And actually we were able to turn it around. But I think by recognising when it was also not where we wanted it to be helps you, A, change that, but also when you get it where you think it should be, you easily recognise it.
Hopefully what we can do is talk about that the next time when you've got time, if that's okay. Yes, but I'd like to thank you very much for your time today. That was great. I say we've not really talked about what we agreed in advance, but I think all of the discussion around the billable hour will hopefully be of significant value to those who listen. So thank you very much.
No, it's been a pleasure. My pleasure. Right. We must do it again.
So thanks very much for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you're enjoying our content. We'd be delighted to hear any feedback that you have. You can find out more about the Your Law Firm Success podcast at mltdigital.co.uk/podcast. Please subscribe, please share with your friends, please share with anyone who you know that you think would be interested.